Hello and welcome to Nobody's Coming to Fix You, a podcast for women, by women, talking all things life, empowerment and transformation. My name is Del Beer. I'm a businesswoman, sustainability advocate, industry leader in my field, and have spent my whole career working in the fashion industry, working out what women actually want. I am the creator of the Sandslang Coaching and Transformation Programme, and I am your host for this podcast. Joining me throughout the series will be lots of fabulous women, and men too, to talk about how we can share the best hacks to live our best lives. Hello and welcome to today's episode of Nobody is Coming to Fix You. I'm very excited to welcome on the show today Rachel McClint from McClint Dating Agency. Now, as you know by now, this podcast is part of Sandslang, which is our coaching and transformation program. Sandslang has four key pillars, which are business and career, personal branding, health and well-being, and of course, relationships. Now, we spent a lot of time talking about the business and career part. We've met loads of fabulous women in business. We've talked about the impact of personal brand on your career and even about health and well-being, but we never got onto the topic of relationships until today. Rachel's dating agency isn't any ordinary dating agency. It is a psychology-based premium dating agency for men and women in the UK and the US. Rachel shares some incredibly valuable insights from her learnings as a CEO of McClint, and I really hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me.
So excited for this episode of Nobody's Coming to Fix You. And that's really because it's the very first time that we get to talk about relationships. Now, with Sandslang, which is our coaching and transformation program, we have four pillars. And the other three pillars, which are business and career, health and wellness, and personal branding, we talk about all the time, but we never got to relationships. So it is particularly exciting that not only are we talking about relationships, but we are talking to you about relationships, the woman who knows it all. So you are the CEO of a very successful dating agency. Tell us a little bit about why you thought of setting up this agency, how long it's been going, the name, share it with the listeners.
So at the very beginning, I studied psychology at university because I always had a natural curiosity about people and helping people to feel good about themselves. All stem back to even my teenage years when I helped one of my now best friends who was being bullied by some not so pleasant people in our school. So I started my career on a pretty positive trajectory by continuing to do a master's in occupational psychology. And then I got into your career as a business psychologist. And I came across matchmaking really through a moment of complete serendipity, which actually happened because I lost my father very suddenly when I just turned 26 years old. And I was living up in Newcastle, and my life was kind of just trudging along. I had a good enough job, and I was in a relationship and it was okay, but you know, nothing in my life was particularly exciting. And losing my father really was, I mean, still to this day, it's like the biggest shock and the biggest trauma that I've gone through. Absolutely knocked me sideways, but that in some ways inspired me or empowered me to make some positive changes in my life. So on the back of that, I started to really focus my goals on moving to London, where I had really always wanted to be. So the moment of serendipity came from seeing a job advert for a matchmaker and a psychologist essentially to join a matchmaking firm in London. And when I saw that advert, it really, really jumped out at me. And I still remember that moment like it was yesterday. And I just thought, this is, if there's ever a calling in life, this is it. This is what I'm meant to do. I didn't know matchmaking existed then at all. This was back in 2007. So I think match.com was kind of, you know, it was being spoken about a little bit, but it was very, it was all still, you know, pretty hush hush. It was certainly not the mainstream styles of dating that we see today. So anyway, I went for the job, loved it, and have never looked back. So I worked for this company for nearly 5 years, and then I think I started to get itchy feet. I was around 30 at the time. And I just thought there's something more that I want to do with my career, but I'm not quite sure what it is. And I had a few people that I knew and trusted in my network who basically gave me the nudge and said, look, why don't you try doing something on your own? And I first thought, well, this sounds terrifying. I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm far too shy, far too lacking in confidence to be doing anything like that. But I started to reflect on what I want my future to look like. And I thought, well, you know, at some point I'm going to want to have kids. And how would that fit in with starting a business and, you know, time scales? And I just thought, you know what, if there's ever a time in my life when I could do this, it's now. So I thought, what the heck, I'll just give it a go and see what happens. So I decided then at that point to set up my business. And for the first 10 years or so, we were called Vida, which is still a name that I love very much, which is my middle name and my mum's name. And of course, it means life in Spanish. So it was the perfect name, really. Well, it was the perfect name until we opened up an office in the US and then realized that there was a trademark issue with another dating company who also happened to be called Vida. So, you know, fair is fair. I had to change our name. And you know, the owner of that company was very decent, and it was all handled in a very professional way. So we changed the name to Macklin, which is my surname, of course.
So now it's Macklin?
Now it's Macklin, yes.
Perfect. And how long have you been going now?
I set the business up 13 years ago.
Tell us a little bit, because you have an operation in London, but also in the US as well. Is that right?
Yeah. So we set up in London originally. And back at the beginning, I, and going back to the whole lack of confidence thing, I had no idea if I was going to be any good at running my own business. So, I mean, I really approached it with a bit of a fly by the seat of my pants kind of method, which for some reason it seemed to serve me quite well over the years. So I started off with a list of 20 people who I knew personally, who were single, different age groups, different demographics. And I approached them all and told them, I've just set up my own agency and I probably need to know some single people. So can I please profile you? And that's really where the whole thing started. And then I started going to networking events and getting referrals. And before I knew it, my diary every day was just absolutely jam packed with different meetings and calls and events. And it was just amazing. The first year was so incredible. So I started building up in London for the first few years. And then as I celebrated our fifth year of business, and we'd won a couple of awards by that point as well, I started to get itchy feet again. And I thought, well, I kind of know London, the London dating scene now, like the back of my hand. But I was getting approached every once in a while from people from different parts of the world, and particularly from the US. So I'd had a few clients from the US that I had worked with. But of course, there was a bit of a challenge because of the time difference and the physical distance. So I started to get curious about what would it be like if I had some kind of presence properly in the US, actually set up an office there. And that seemed to coincide with me being approached by my now business partner, Nick Visavati, who had also spotted the opportunity and was looking for a different type of business to invest into. And, you know, he wanted to invest and be a mentor. He's a big advocate of female founded businesses. So anyway, long story short, he invested. And by the time that was all sort of finalized, I already had one child. I had then my second. And when my youngest child was 3 months old, I hopped on a plane and went over to New York and set up our office there, which was a very stressful experience, not going to lie, but it was really invigorating and something that I'm really pleased that I did. So now we have an office in New York, and we also set up an office in California about 3 or 4 years ago.
But you're the CEO, so you are the main person in charge. How do you split your time now between London and the US?
Yes, my time. That's a big topic. Being a CEO and being a mum, I'm still learning how to juggle those two. I spend most of my time in London. I travel to the US usually 2, maybe 3 times a year. I don't like to leave my children too much, if possible. But of course, you know, we're living in a world now where it's very easy to conduct business over Zoom. So I spend a lot of time with the team in the US, but I have two incredible partners there who run our offices. So they're amazing at what they do. And that allows the US entity to have more autonomy. And then we really focus on delivering the operational side and the operational support from London, and then the ongoing mentoring, really.
Before we get into the conversation around the dating business, I think it is, like you say, really an interesting topic that you start your own business, which comes with its own challenges. Then you have a family, then you expand your business overseas, trying to find your balance in all of that. That's just such a complex thing that all entrepreneurs and founders struggle with.
I remember in the earlier years of me being a CEO, and I've had various coaches over the years and mentors, and, you know, a big advocate of that. But one of the biggest questions that I've asked, which, you know, sounds a little bit daft, but I have often asked mentors and coaches, what am I supposed to be doing? What is my actual role as a CEO? Because I feel like a lot of the time I'm reacting to things and I'm supporting, and sometimes I feel like I'm the admin support for other members of the team, and I'm sort of stepping in and, you know, helping to fill the gaps. And also asking questions around how am I supposed to juggle being a mom, and I want to be a hands-on mom, and I don't want to just be, you know, palming off responsibility to nannies and all sorts. And that, you know, I have got answers, and I've worked out my own method and my own strengths really with that over the years. But I find it really useful and comforting to speak to other female founders who are mothers as well, and just picking their brains about, you know, how do you make it work, and what ideas do you have, and should I be feeling guilty for this, and, you know, what happens if I'm away when there's an important show on at my son's school or something like that. And it's hard making those compromises. I'm trying to balance the two, but it's an ongoing learning process.
And also so interesting what you say about, you know, how to be a CEO. Like, we all just assume that if you start the company, well, you're in charge, you know what to do. But actually, you know, there comes a point when you've got teams and people who are doing the job, and you have to work out, well, where is my role in all of this? And you don't want to be that person that's filling in the gaps and, you know, stepping in for people. You want to be able to lead the team from the front. But I have this conversation quite a lot with people who say, I've never been trained to be a CEO. And I think that's just really something that we probably need to think about, because there's so many female founders coming through now. And I think that one minute you're doing everything, so it doesn't really matter, you know, because you're just making the business work. But the minute you get to that first stage of growth where you've probably got a couple of employees, I think learning to kind of adapt your role so that you can serve the business best and support your teams and empower the teams, that's something that I think a lot of people struggle with.
It's hard trying to, I mean, it sounds cliche, but trying to take yourself from working in the business to working on the business. But, you know, there is such a distinction between the two. I feel quite fortunate that it was about 2 or 3 years ago, I was able to get the business to a level, and I've got an amazing business partner, Mia, in London, who is like the best right-hand woman anyone could ever hope to have. So she really focuses on the internal operations of the business and supports everyone so much. And by having her by my side, that allowed me, really for the first time since I had set up the business, to elevate myself, put myself in that, you know, metaphorical helicopter, and really look at where we were as a business and start to think about strategic growth without feeling like I'm drowning in work. And that marked a time when we went through a full rebrand of the business as well. That also coincided with the name change, so we were able to pull everything together quite seamlessly. But that was lovely for me to be able to sit down with branding experts, different business planners, and really map out the brand, which in the early days was just me, you know, this is how I want things done. And this is what my values are in terms of the way the service should be delivered. I'm trying to influence other people in the team to do things the way I want them done. To be able to pull all of that together and turn it into a full branding document. And we've got tone of voice document. And then we were working with copywriters and everything, and it was an expensive process to go through, but that really marked a pivotal point for us in the business where all of a sudden I know now, not that I'm planning on, but if I was ever hypothetically to step back from the business, we now have my personality, my values now written in a very detailed branding document. So it's all very clear about who we are as a business. And that has shaped everything to a much more detailed level than it ever has before, because it influences how we hire, who we hire, how we communicate with the sort of outside world through marketing activities, but also how we're communicating with our own team and with our clients. So there's a lovely consistency there now. I mean, that was 10 years before we were able to get the business to the stage that I could really elevate to that next level.
And I suppose it's not just whether, you know, like whether you're there or you're stepping back, it's just for as you expand and new people are coming into the organization all the time, it's being able to hand them those documents from day one and say, this is the kind of hymn sheet that we're all singing off, you know, so that people don't start taking, because that's quite hard to sometimes keep the identity intact whilst as you enter more markets and you can't be everywhere all of the time.
Yeah, that's a very valid point, is that even if I'm here every day, there are many members of the team who really don't have that much contact with me at all. So I speak to Mia all day, every day. You know, she pretty much knows what I have for breakfast every day. And then it dissipates really from there. So I try and keep in contact with other members of the team as much as possible. You know, I'll find and try and do it in a more organic way rather than having structured meetings with the big boss. So I'll find excuses to call anyone in the team, even if it's an assistant or, you know, someone who's fairly new to the team, so that I can have a bit of a chin wag with them and give them some snippets of advice and insights, because essentially I've done it all. There's not a single experience that anyone in the team will go through that I haven't experienced myself, whether it's dealing with a tricky client or how to work out how to change the font on our newsletter. It's like, I've been there, done the whole thing.
And is it a mainly female team?
Do you know, it is a mainly female team, and that has never been a conscious decision. We sometimes get praised for that. We also sometimes get criticized for it as well, that we're excluding men. My business partner, Nick, is a man. And we have a matchmaker in LA, Alex, who is incredible. We've had other male members of the team as well over the years. But I think the world of matchmaking seems to draw in probably 95% women as an industry trend.
So you started the dating business at the same time that online dating is beginning to gain a lot of momentum. And that has obviously, you know, it's blown up. It's been huge for years and years. And you've carried on growing at the same time. I'm really curious to share with the listeners what the business model is. Like, what is it that you offer that is obviously, I mean, it's very obvious, you know, it's very different from an online dating. But I think there's so many nuances to what you do. And I'm particularly excited about this psychology-backed focus that you have. So please share a little bit about the model.
We set up about a year before Tinder was launched. And yeah, so I'm not going to lie, that was quite worrying when all of a sudden this silver bullet platform that was free, and all you had to do was to swipe left or right and you would find love. And I think all matchmakers experience a bit of a jaw-dropping moment when they thought, oh my goodness, we're all going to be out of business in the next year. But of course, that didn't happen at all, because it became very apparent quite quickly that dating apps are designed really with a different objective in mind, regardless of what they communicate through their various marketing platforms. I will add, though, that I am not against dating apps in principle. I know lots of people who have found their match successfully through dating apps. In fact, we also help our clients with how to manage their online dating profiles if they so wish. The differentiation really between the typical dating app and our service is, I mean, it really is like night and day. Our service is not a public platform. We keep everything offline. It is very much set in a foundation of being very private and very discreet. Our clients really demand that. They require that, partly because a lot of our clients have got a public profile themselves, or they're very successful in their respective industry. We take our clients through a much more consultative model. So we developed a five-stage framework for our clients, knowing that most people who come to us, in fact, just most people out there in the singles world, are feeling jaded by dating. They're feeling exhausted. They're despondent. They're fed up. It should be simple to find a partner. You know, why are there so many thousands and thousands of single people in every city, and yet it seems to be impossible to find anyone of any interest? You know, the whole thing just doesn't quite make sense. So our role really is to help people to overcome any of those obstacles and to try and deliver a service which is more seamless and more empowering, and, you know, hopefully a more positive experience, with, of course, the sole objective of our clients finding a relationship with someone compatible. The five-step methodology that we take our clients through allows them to really almost segment their journey into five very palatable stages. And that, you know, they all morph into each other a little bit. You know, we'll go back a step and forward a step, and but it does help to keep the whole thing focused. So the first step that we guide our clients through is really all about helping them to recognize who they are within themselves. So before they start pulling their wish list out of their wallet and, you know, presenting it to us, it's like, okay, well, let's just wait, hold off on that a second. Let's just focus on you. Do you know who you are? What are your values? What do you stand for in life? What was it that led you to travel through most of your 20s? And why did you set up this business at the age of 26? And why did you decide to go off on some, you know, interesting adventure for a couple of years, and the soul searching that you've done, the friends that you keep? What does all of that say about you as an individual? And that's what we're really trying to delve into. Once we explore people's story with them, and everyone has their own unique story that is, you know, always going to be different and, you know, completely unique, well, then that helps us to understand their values. And also we're looking at their outlook on life. So everyone will also have a vision for their future, and we all have our sort of dreams and goals and aspirations. And the more we can encourage people to articulate that and to visualize that, the easier it is for us to guide them in terms of the type of person and the relationship that they should be looking for. So that's the first step. The second step then is looking at their ideal partner profile. And online dating has, unfortunately, it's programmed most single people into believing that a compatible partner is someone who you just seem to fancy based on a photograph. He's hot or she is hot. And of course, when you're coming to find a long-term partner, a life partner, there are so many more factors that need to be considered and that need to slot into place. Otherwise, the compatibility just won't be there. Online dating is not designed to help people find a compatible long-term partner. It's designed to help people find a date. And we're trying to help our clients to find a compatible long-term partner. So we help them to build up that profile. And a profile of someone compatible will be an individual who has complementing values. Doesn't have to be a carbon copy, but complementing values to the clients, and also a similar outlook on life. So we help them to carve that out, and also we can bring our own insights and expertise into the dating landscape, and what's realistic, and, you know, what kind of obstacles or pitfalls that the client needs to consider. So that's the second step. The third step then is thinking not just so much about the individual, but the backdrop of the actual of the relationship itself. So looking at roles within a relationship. Is someone looking for something quite traditional, stay-at-home mom, the working dad type thing, which is less common nowadays? More people are looking, you know, they'll quite often say, I'm looking for a partner in crime. And, you know, they want their relationship to be more of a double act, which is great. You know, they want to both maintain their respective careers, whether or not they choose to go on and have children. And so we explore all of that, and all done in a very non-judging, very respectful way. Everyone has got the right to choose what kind of relationship they really want. We just ask the questions to help them to think about some important factors and to articulate clearly, not just for our benefit, but also for theirs. We'll also look at things like love languages, which can be quite fun, and attachment styles. So bringing a little bit more of the psychology in. And then the fourth step is, once we know who they are and the type of partner they're looking for and the relationship that they want, the next step is, okay, how do we go about finding this person? Where are they? A lot of our clients they're looking for a partner anywhere in the world. They don't want to set any geographical restrictions. So that's quite a big task for us. We don't want to leave any stone unturned. That's a lot of stones. So we put together a full search strategy for our clients so that we can network anywhere and everywhere. And because, you know, this is what we do as a business, we're already a few steps ahead of the game with all of our clients because we already have a network that we have been growing continuously over the last 10, 13 years. So that is our first port of call really for finding partners for our clients. But in addition to that, we're also looking for new single people through a whole variety of different networking activities. So, and then once we find people who we think would be potentially compatible for a client, we have a full consultation with them to present, here is a match who I think would be compatible with you. Let me tell you about him or her and explain why we think that this could potentially be a fit. And we want to really be respectful of our clients' own individual views as well. So we never tell them who they want, who they should be meeting. We consult with them and bring them into the conversation. That also allows them to have a more increased level of self-learning and feel empowered with that decision-making process. Once we set up the dates and the client goes on to have the date, I mean, we'll get involved in, if it's needed or required, anything from helping them to decide what to wear on the dates. We help to recommend venues. Sometimes we book a restaurant or a bar for them to go to. Some people don't want that. Some people do. Again, it's fully flexible. And after they have the date, a really important part of the process is to speak to both parties so that we can get that all valuable feedback about how it went. And that can be quite insightful because it's unbelievable how many people go on dates. And there's just, you know, it's essentially two strangers at the point at which they're first meeting. But there is so much that is left to open to misinterpretation. And once we hear feedback from both parties, quite often we're able to help pull together a relationship that maybe otherwise would never have happened in the first place because she thought that he wasn't particularly interested or the other way around. And, you know, maybe they decide never to meet again. And if we feel that there is potential there to continue, we can help to have that, gentle influence and some coaching to sort of guide our couples through the next phases of dating and hopefully into a relationship, which all leads to the fifth step in our model, which is really to allow our clients to date with meaning and purpose. And that's where a lot of the psychology comes in. So we're speaking to our clients all the time about, you know, really considering what is important on a date and how we can feed their feedback about one person into how we're selecting the next person for them to meet and how they should maybe consider some nuances and their behaviors and their communication styles. So every interaction, every single touch point they have with us serves as a very delicate, discreet, subtle learning experience for them. So that's how we're different to dating apps.
Oh my God, I feel like we've got enough for like three episodes of this podcast. I was like, so much to unpack in this last segment that you've just talked about. It's so fascinating, but I'm going to go back to the bit where you talk about helping to build a profile. This is really interesting. It's like almost people are like putting together like their ideal person. It's almost like a vision board, I guess, like a business plan. You know, that sounds very technical and business-like, but like you're giving them the chance to maybe separate what they visually find attractive to probably what they're, you're allowing them to bring together their sort of like visual kind of like desires with their purpose and their values and other things, I guess.
Yeah, 100%. We run a masterclass called How to Conquer Online Dating, which my colleague Madeline and I put together actually during the pandemic. And it still to today has proven to be one of our most popular masterclasses. And it is absolutely bursting at the seams with advice and statistics and trends and research. And it actually served as a real eye-opener for me, the extent to which online dating is, there's a real science to it. It's not just about I'm attractive and I'm confident, so if I go on a date with someone that I've met online, well, you know, of course I can handle this. I know what I'm doing. That's not really the point. The point quite often is navigating through the platform in the first place. If you don't know what you're doing and you don't know what influences the right sort of responses that you're looking for, well, then you're just, you find yourself treading water. And that's why a lot of people who are really very matchable and very desirable individuals are feeling so frustrated and wondering, why am I struggling with this? And all they need to do is learn how to master online dating. They don't need to change anything about themselves. They just need to know how to put a really strong profile together, the right types of photographs. We have lots of statistics around what type of photographs lead to a better response from the, whether it's the opposite sex, same sex or whatever. And we can share that with our members, the style of communication. Madeline quite often talks about approaching online dating like a recruitment process. So you're putting out an advert for someone to come and sort of apply for a relationship with you. And you need to make sure that that advert is worded absolutely flawlessly, not too generic, not too specific. You don't want anyone and everyone to apply to that advert. It's not a popularity contest. You want to put off unsuitable people and you only want to draw in people who are suitable. And that is a prime mistake that people make with online dating. They just want to feel popular and they want as much interest from people as possible. So they create a profile which is just too vague and too generic, and then it just, everything falls between the cracks.
I heard this a little while ago, and it was, I can't remember who was having this conversation, and they said exactly the same thing. If we treated our dating profiles like a job application, our success would look quite different. And this person, she was saying that, like, but there's a job application form and it says, why would you be suitable for this job? We could spend hours, days thinking about that, finding, like you say, all the right things to say, the things that make us unique. And then it comes to our dating profile and more people than less will say, yeah, I like country walks, watching Netflix, having a glass of wine. You know, like we all kind of like, and I don't know what it is, why we don't have the same level of respect for this when we actually are looking for somebody that's probably going to last a lot longer in your life than your next job. And same with photos as well. And I'm always hearing that, you know, again, like when we're, and I'm going to come on and talk about headshots in a second because we did a big exercise on that last week. But when it comes to our LinkedIn profile, we're often like careful about the shot that we put on there. We often kind of spend some time curating a really good shot there. And then on the dating sites, you know, you've got people, you know, with four other people on their profile picture or looking all hot and sweaty up a mountain or something, which is also fine to have like a sporty image. But I think that sometimes women sometimes don't even present themselves in a way that people can really understand what they look like. And I don't know why we approach dating profiles so differently to like jobs.
Yeah, I think that there's a vulnerability associated with it. So we have a natural tendency to bury our head in the sand and think, oh, I'll just stick this photograph up and hopefully, you know, it'll sort itself out, everything will be fine. And I think we also have an influence from our parents' generation and grandparents' generation of, well, you know, you shouldn't really need to be using these platforms because you should just be able to bump into your ideal partner. It should all happen by chance. And if someone values themselves as an individual, well, why can't I just bump into someone? We experience the whole, you know, romanticism of movies that also teach us that, you know, we should be able to just catch someone's eye across a crowded room. But the world has changed now. Men are also very concerned about approaching women because they don't want to insult or offend. So, you know, that men are backing off, and I think the whole landscape really has changed. You know, Bumble is hugely successful. And it's incredible to see that, you know, its whole model is based on women making the first move. And, you know, so that marks a big shift, really, in how people are approaching dating. But I think my advice to, you know, to women in particular who are, you know, really wanting to achieve success with dating is try and approach it with your business hat on. Go about it in a pragmatic way. And that isn't to say that you should suppress the feelings of excitement. Keep that for the date when it's going well. But the actual experience on a date and the journey to get to being on that date are actually quite different. And if you map out everything, put together a plan, put together a strategy, which is what we help our clients do, but the advice we give our clients can be applied to people out there in the dating world. It doesn't require having to spend tens of thousands of pounds on with a matchmaker. You can do it all for free if you want, because it's just applying a method, and the method is actually really simple if you break it down. What we teach our clients is not rocket science at all. What we tell our clients about how to put together an online dating profile, we have a masterclass, which I think that, you know, the whole segment really where we're talking about what to do to put together an online dating profile lasts about 45 minutes. And it, you know, as I said, it's bursting with information. But if anyone was to listen to that 45 minutes, I can guarantee you it will transform how you, the kind of success that you would have with online dating. Because it's just a few simple tips, which is all research based on, you know, you want to have a clear headshot. As soon as someone has to try and guess what you look like, because you're hiding behind a set of a pair of sunglasses, or you've got a hat on, or they're trying to work out who you are in a group of four or five people, then that's it. You've lost your opportunity. It's gone. Or if the photograph is a little bit too grainy, and therefore it might look as though it's dated, and therefore they think, well, maybe you don't look like that anymore. If it's old, again, you've lost them, it's gone. You have to make it really simple for the other person by having a clear selection of photographs. And there is research that will say that you should also have at least one photograph which is full length, and you should have at least one photograph which demonstrates something that's important to you in your lifestyle. So if you are someone that's very outdoorsy, have an outdoorsy photograph. If you're someone who's very social, or even if you're not, actually, it's also puts across a good impression to have a photograph, not the main profile one, but another photograph, which maybe does showcase your family and or friends or your pet, you know, whatever it might be. But there has to be a clear headshot, and there has to be a selection of other photographs that sort of showcase different elements of who you are. I went to a conference in San Diego last September, and there was another trend that was being spoken quite a lot about then, about the types of photographs that people should have for their online dating profiles. Because I get asked quite often, oh, do I need to go and have a photo shoot? And actually, in this day and age, I think that a lot of people can get away without having a photo shoot. Because, you know, if you've got your iPhone or smartphone or whatever, you know, those cameras are all absolutely incredible. But again, there's a bit of an art to how you should take your picture. Or if you're speaking to someone, if you're having a Zoom date, which a lot of our clients are, you have to make sure that the camera is always slightly above your eye line. Otherwise, it just doesn't give you a very flattering picture. And, you know, so none of this is about manipulating. It's just giving a good first impression. You should never manipulate photographs. That's just the worst thing anyone can do. Don't do it. No photoshopping. Don't use old photographs. Be who you are. Do not shock people when you turn up on a date and you look different from the person online. That's never going to serve anyone. The trend that's coming out in the US, which I love, is what they're calling planned photographs. So it's a candid photograph, which is planned. So you'll see that, I mean, you see it used in other contexts, but we have two photographers that we use for our clients, for those who want some professional photographs taken. It's not a prerequisite, but they will take photographs which aren't staged. So we never do anything in a studio. I just don't like studio shots. Our photographers will take our client out or go to their home, and the best photographs will be when they are maybe looking at the distance and laughing, or, you know, they're caught off guard, but the backdrop is maybe a little bit planned and the outfit is planned, but it looks more, much more natural and more organic. And I think it captures a little bit more essence of the client's personality.
Do you think that people would be cynical about whether, even if it was a kind of a candid shot, if it was a professional shot versus a kind of, because you can still kind of tell when you've had a professional shot done. Do you think people would be like, oh, this looks too manicured?
Manicured is, so the one thing that I tell people not to do is to have a dating photograph where it's a photograph that really should be on your LinkedIn profile, because you're wearing a suit jacket, your arms are closed, you know, that's closed body language. Don't do that for dating. Or the whole, let's put your hand on your hip and look over your shoulder, 1980s cringe. Don't do that, because we don't normally stand like that. It's not a natural posture or way of posing. So I think professional photographs are fine, but you have to be positioned in a way that is natural and comfortable. Because it is quite easy to detect if someone is feeling awkward in a photograph, and that will have a subconscious influence on the impression that the other people looking at the photograph will have.
This is amazing. I think the masterclass sounds fantastic. We should link it on our podcast, actually, because I think, you know, people definitely need to, you know, do that masterclass, because I feel that so many people who are struggling and falling at the first hurdle, literally because their profile is so generic and they've never ever had that conversation that we're just having now, which is like, treat it like it's a job that you really want, put a bit of time into it, think about the shots, and also don't put on shots that don't represent you on a regular day. I mean, you sometimes see women who are putting on shots from like a wedding or a major event or something. And I think that's fine to have as one of your shots. But, you know, if that's all people see, then they're also going to be in for a surprise when they meet you at a coffee shop.
Yeah, and your hair is scraped back. And actually, you might look more gorgeous in the coffee shop because, you know, it's a more natural version. It's less intimidating as well. So, you know, people can feel a bit put off if they think that their partner is going to be too polished all the time and it's all, yeah, a bit too staged. So there is so much to learn. Dating is a minefield. We, as a team of matchmakers, we are reading every day. We're looking at academic papers. We're looking at blogs, dating trends, trying to stay up to speed all the time. And, you know, even then we have a team of 25 of us who are, you know, constantly discovering new statistics and new patterns and new trends and, you know, new ways of advising our clients. And, you know, this is our full-time job. But what we aim to do is pull together some of the nuggets of information and then present that, share that with our clients, share that on our social media platforms to try and help guide people. And what is quite nice is that most of the steps that people can take are actually really simple if they're just told, right, here's literally 10 bullet points on how to have the best photographs on your online dating profile. And once you read it and you do it, that's it. It's done. It's really simple. You don't need to worry about it again. Or how to write a really effective message, how to spot time wasters. Once you get into some of these topics, a lot of our clients find it really interesting, but they will always come away with some really simple, actionable advice, which anyone could use and apply to their dating life.
And in terms of, like, you know, the coaching, so you just say, so we've moved forward now and, like, you know, you've done your profile, you've attracted a couple of potential dates, people have been on a few dates. If you found that there was some recurring feedback that was coming through about one particular candidate of yours, how do you go about then kind of letting that person know they might be harming their own chances of success?
Yeah. Okay. So that's a really good question, because that happens a lot. One of the benefits of using a matchmaker is that we can observe from a distance really what is going on with dating, listening to the client's feedback and looking out for if there's any differences that they present versus other clients that we're working with. So we usually have a pretty strong insight into if there are any flaws or any blocks. And then we can discuss how to address them. So if we do spot something like that, by that point, we spend a lot of time with our clients. We build a strong rapport. That's part of our job to do that as well, is to allow our clients to have a safe space. You know, we're very friendly with our clients. And, you know, so quite often, you know, it wouldn't, if someone was a fly on the wall, they would think that we're just chin wagging all day with our clients and, you know, how was your day and chit chat, you know, how did your date go? And it all sounds very fun. But actually, we're really listening intently to their feedback and their thoughts and what's going well and what's not going well and what they're worried about. And listening to all of that helps us to think, okay, well, we're observing something. So we're all trained on how to approach those conversations and making sure that we're going about it in a really respectful way. But essentially, we would open up the conversation by asking permission. You know, I've observed some, you know, patterns here from your recent dates that you've been on. Are you happy for me to share with you some of my thoughts? So we'll always get permission from the client. And, you know, most clients are there because they do want the feedback and, you know, they want to learn. And then we'll share with them. You know, it seems that when you've been on three dates now with three different people, and we've had feedback from all three that you've been talking a lot about your ex, which is, that happens quite often. So, you know, then, you know, we just have a conversation about how dating really should be approached, especially the first date and the types of conversations really that would be optimal to have, and some topics that would be better avoided until there is a little bit more emotional intimacy built up, which usually would be for a few dates down the line, and just knowing at what point you should open up certain layers of vulnerability. But really, you know, the first date should be more about having fun with someone before you're getting into anything that's too heavy. But that can be quite transformational for our clients.
That's really interesting that you are coaching them all the way through the process. I mean, to get a chance to be able to like almost like look in a mirror and be able to refine your behavior and maybe think, ah, okay, I didn't realize I was doing that on a regular basis. And because that's something you're not going to get in online dating, you're going to carry on, you know, it's a repeat behavior every time you go on a new date. So I think the idea that you can kind of evolve and learn and be kind of given some feedback, it's absolutely wonderful. Is there like a magic number of dates that people often go on before they hit success?
Between 3 and 5. Depending on the person.
Right.
Yeah, it'll depend. With some clients, they will, if they're very self-aware at the beginning of their journey with us, then we can hit success with them pretty early on in the process. Some of our clients will be matched successfully with their first introduction. Others will need more exploration. So they will maybe explore different types of people. And, you know, again, that's all done with full awareness from them about this is the approach that we're taking. It's quite unusual for a client to go on more than 10 dates before they hit success with someone. But, you know, it really varies from person to person. Some people are very broad in terms of who they would genuinely be compatible with, because they're just, you know, that's just the way their mind is. And some people, they're, you know, different reasons for why their compatible partner is someone that's really quite niche, and therefore the number of dates that they would go on would be less, but more likely to have success early on.
Obviously, this podcast is for women, and it's all about tips, tricks, and hacks that, you know, we can kind of share for women to live their best lives. We've talked about, obviously, you know, your best profile, your best headshots, you know, for your online profile. What other things do you think that women could do, or what are they doing at the moment, do you think, that kind of hinder their progress?
So in addition to approaching dating a bit, sometimes with too much emotion, as I said before, and just trying to be a bit more pragmatic, the other thing is walking away from an opportunity because the first date hasn't come with fireworks and a sort of earth moving experience. Men do this as well, so it's not just women, but we do see a very strong trend of people expecting, that they expect so much on a first date, and what they don't necessarily appreciate is that people are at their most nervous on a first date. So their own behavior and their sparkle might be dampened when they turn up on the date. And then that's combined with their date also being the same, maybe a little bit nervous and a bit sort of withdrawn. So you combine both of those behaviors together and all of a sudden it's exacerbated even more. So a lot of people believe that if they don't have a really strong experience on that first date, well, then it's going to go downhill from there. And actually, that's not the case at all. Quite often, the magic and the spark will come 2, 3, 4, 5, even, you know, more than 5 dates down the line, particularly if you're at the stage in life when you are actually looking for a life partner. You're not just looking for a date that may or may not lead to a relationship, because, you know, we're young, free and single in our, you know, late teens or 20s, you know, when you're not thinking about your whole life, then dating suddenly becomes like a very serious project. And so when we turn up on a date, we're also thinking about, you know, there's always 1,000 questions that would go through our minds about, you know, can I imagine having children with this person? And, you know, whether it's conscious or subconscious questions, we're analyzing, we're assessing constantly, and that can also lead us to maybe be a little bit more distracted, not as present as we would normally be. So my advice would be, if you have a date with someone, and as long as the first date is okay, the feedback has, you know, only needs to be neutral at best, then go on another date. And if that date is also okay, and you think that there's any hint of potential, go on another date and keep going until you are absolutely 100% sure that there's no way in heck that it's ever going to lead into something long term. But also know what to look out for on that date as well. It's not just about the physical attraction. Yes, that is important, but people fall into a bit of a habit of interviewing their partner and not really understanding what they're interviewing for. But actually, the reason why when a date is going really well and you're sharing stories and you just feel like, oh my God, you know, there's a real connection here, there's a real bond, what is that actually all about? That is a foundation of recognizing that you and your date have got a basis of shared values and shared aspirations. And from that, you're pinging out all these stories. I've been there, and, you know, I love traveling in Asia, and I did some of that, you know, whenever I was in my 20s, or, you know, whatever the stories might be. So we start to share stories based on connecting values together. And once we understand what we're trying to discover about each other on a date, whether it's the first, second, third date, whatever, then we can start to think about what we want to be focusing our attention on and not asking so many questions around, so what happened with your last relationship, and getting into, you know, tell me about your job, and it feeling like a bit of a boring interview.
Wow. I'm still stuck on the bit where you say that keep on attending the date, even if you're not fully blown away, and like, until such time that you can actually say this is definitely not for me, then persevere. And I think that is that probably will be my biggest takeaway from this conversation, because I'm probably the kind of person that like is very quick to decide if I'm excited about being in an environment, you know, whether it could be in a hotel, it could be out with girlfriends, it could be on a date, but I'm not sure that I would have the patience to keep on coming back. And I think I make up my mind very, very quickly about whether I think this is right for me or not. And it's really interesting to reflect on that point, which I will be doing later on today, about whether, you know, like about just saying to yourself, well, there was nothing bad happened, so therefore it's worth another, you know, visit or another date or whatever. And just see if there's something that can kind of emerge over a series of dates. That's amazing.
The reason why I'm suggesting that, why I advise people to do that, is based on my observations over the years, of which there are literally thousands of instances of people who have gone on dates that I have, you know, I've got an insight into dating that is just pretty rare, that, you know, most people don't have. And I have seen so many encounters where people have gone on a first date and come back and said, not sure, don't know, the earth didn't move, it was, you know, he was nice, she was nice, but, you know, nothing magical. And they have persevered and they've gone on another date. And maybe it would be on the second date they come back, or the third or the fourth, and say, I don't know what has happened, but I've gone from thinking, well, we could potentially be friends, to I suddenly fancy the pants off this person. And there is suddenly this spark and this connection. And if you don't allow yourself to be patient and to be, you know, a little bit vulnerable, it's very easy to be caught on this hamster wheel of just going on first dates, waiting for this absolute magical moment that may never come. I'm not saying that you'd never get magic on a first date, but for a lot of people, there's nothing wrong with it coming on the second, third or fourth date.
What would you say is a common thing that men complain about when it comes to dating women? Is there any sort of like regular feedback that comes back?
I think one of the main topics is the whole who on earth is supposed to be paying.
Really?
How am I supposed to be treating a woman in a way that is showing old school chivalry? A lot of men, they want to be chivalrous by paying for a date. They want to open the door. They want to make sure that a woman gets home safely, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But I think now a lot of men are a bit worried and scared that that is considered as disrespectful or patronizing. But then when they don't do it, they get criticized the opposite way and told, well,
yeah,
just split the bill, or he, you know, didn't open the door, or he didn't, you know, I was struggling to get an Uber and he didn't offer to help, or, you know, whatever it might be. So I think men are a bit confused about what is the right and the wrong thing to do. Again, from my observation, and we work with a lot of clients who are, you know, very much feminist, but when it comes to relationships, heterosexual relationships, they still are very much advocates of, well, I want a man to be a man on a date, and I want him to embrace my femininity, and I want to embrace his masculinity, and that's essentially the partnership that we're looking for. There's a bit of a sort of an education piece there, I think, to help men be less confused.
I'm with the guys on this though, and I know that won't be a popular opinion, but I, you know, so many times on social media, I see all of these very conflicting opinions, like, you know, treat us like a woman. Oh, how dare you, don't treat me like an equal, you know? And I think it's difficult for guys in every respect. Now, like you said, you know, even chatting to somebody in a bar, they're worried about doing that because that could get, you know, misconstrued, you know, where the line is in terms between, you know, chivalry and, you know, equality. I think that it's almost like you probably need to ask the female date before they go out to kind of fill out their tick list of like what they expect. Like, do they want to go halves? Do they want to have a taxi home or whatever? Because I do think it's really hard for the guys to work this bit out, because I think women are all over the place on it.
You know, interestingly, we did exactly that.
Wow.
When we introduced a few years ago, we do full profiling with all of our members. We're asking questions about all sorts of things. But one of the sections that we cover is about dating patterns and expectations, and asking exactly that. What are your expectations in terms of a date, and who should be paying, and how you should be, you know, the sort of style of communication? Because, you know, there are some people who, you know, they want to be treated like a bit of a princess, and, you know, what, you know, some people will agree with that, some people won't, but that's what they believe. And some people will want something which is completely equal. You know, I want to pay my way. I want this to be, you know, a complete sort of 50-50 split in every way in the relationship. You know, that's fine as well. What we're very much focused on is just respecting everyone's unique views, and helping to navigate the right matches based on that, because that actually forms part of the compatibility assessment.
I think that I've learned so much today. I think our listeners will learn so much from this. And I think there's definitely, I will get the link for the masterclass as well and put that on the podcast, and any other references or anything else that people can look at. I think there's a lot of women out there at the moment who are finding, you know, and men as well, who are really jaded about the whole process now. And I think for the first time, I feel like I'm meeting a lot of people who are saying, do you know what? I'm just not bothered. I'm just not interested. I don't know whether that's happening more than the past, or I feel like I hear it a lot. People just saying it just feels like too much like hard work. Do you think it's getting worse, or do you think people are still dating as much as they used to?
Online dating world is now so overpopulated with apps. I think people are totally overwhelmed. Yeah, in some ways, I do think it is getting worse, and people are kind of just abandoning their dating lives altogether. I think if anyone is feeling like that, get in contact with us, because there's all sorts of resources we're very happy to share, some of which are completely free. And then, you know, we have our various different types of events and workshops and talks and coaching, and obviously the full matchmaking. So, you know, we offer a full variety of support and resource.
We're going to share all of that on our show notes. And and I think anything that you're doing in the future as well, share that with us so we can share it with our community as well. It has been a fascinating conversation, honestly. I mean, I feel this should be a Netflix six-parter. I really think it would be brilliant, actually. I would be watching. But no, it's amazing. And I think there's so many learnings out of today's podcast. And thank you so much for your time, Rachel.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed the episode today. To learn more about McLynn Dating Agency, please check the show notes where you can find out more information. See you next week. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Nobody's Coming to Fix You. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please follow us and subscribe for future episodes. If you have any questions about the content of the show, all the details will be in the show notes. You can also reach out to us on Instagram and TikTok at Santaland Coaching. Nobody's Coming to Fix You is brought to you by Santaland, a 12-month coaching and transformation program for women. To learn more, please go to www.santaland.com. I'm your host, Albea. Until next time, stay well.